Good afternoon, everybody. Welcome to Metro. I'm your host, Roger Wendell. 3:08's the time. Imagine selling all of your treasured possessions, leaving your comfortable life behind, and heading out for unknown lands equipped with nothing but a bicycle, the bare essentials, and a map. Travel with Tim and Cindy Travis as they ride thousands of miles through Ecuador, Peru, Bolivia, Argentina, and Chile. Experience what it's like to be an American abroad during wartime, be invited into people's homes and share their food, cultures, traditions, and escape roadside robbers, sleep under the stars, witness the breathtaking beauty and diversity and devastating poverty of South America. My guests this afternoon are Tim and Cindy Travis. They join us by telephone. Tim and Cindy, welcome to Metro.
Thank you, Roger.
Hi, Roger.
Good to have you here. There's a lot I want to talk about your latest book, and that's Down the Road in South America, a bicycle tour through poverty, paradise, and places in between. Very interesting read. But I wanted to get some general impressions as we started off in the program. You've been on the road since 2002, and we're going to talk about the beginning and how you embarked on this adventure. But as it stands now, your most recent experience, are people around the world from your travels much interested in what's going on here in the States as far as maybe our election? And are there any feelings about the economy as of late?
Oh, gosh. Before May, we flew to Alaska in May, but before that we were in New Zealand. And it's a big topic. Everybody wants to know, the first thing they ask us is who's going to win, and of course we can't answer that. And after that they want us to explain the Electoral College and who's running, and they often confuse the primary with the general election. So yes, everybody, when they found out we were American, wanted to know how things are going to go politically.
I know it's not a very scientific sampling, but do you have any impressions as to who they want to win? Is there much interest in Obama, maybe McCain? What's the toll so far?
Well, from the people we met, it was definitely, and this is in traveling circles and youth hostels and places like that, but definitely people abroad seem to want Barack Obama to win.
Okay.
Can I add, just recently we rode through Victoria, British Columbia, on Vancouver Island, and we were on the bike path, and I looked up, and I saw a billboard that said, Obama for President, and I said, Tim, are we in Canada? I was really surprised to see that billboard.
So a lot of interest in the election, and certainly a lot of concern and anguish over the economy, too. But more importantly, you address throughout the book a lot of poverty that you encountered in South America. And like I mentioned, we'll talk a lot about your latest book, but we can also speak in general terms because you've basically been all over the planet on your bicycles. It's an exciting adventure. But let's take a step back in time, back into 2002, when you decided to embark on this basically never-ending bicycle ride around the world. Tell us where you were at back in 2000, 2001, 2002, what you were doing, and what made you decide basically to sell all of your worldly possessions and take off on bicycles.
Ms. Cindy?
Oh, okay. I wasn't sure who was going to answer. Well, in 2002, we were in Arizona, and I was working as a geologist, and Tim was working as a special ed teacher, and we had been saving money, and Tim came up with an idea of traveling around the world, and I thought, no, no, no. And he took a little while to convince me, but I started thinking about it, and the more I thought about it, well, we have a house we already want. We already have cars, and we don't have children. And I thought, wow, I guess I'm just working for the next 15 years for a bigger house and some more cars. And so this idea that Tim wanted to just save the money and go traveling started to sound appealing because I love to travel. And it took him a little while, but he convinced me, and then I just thought, why not? We should do this. And that's when the plans really started to come together.
Once she was convinced, then it was full steam, and we put everything we owned on the driveway, and we sold almost everything in a garage sale. We still own the house, but we rented it. But practically everything we own now is on a bike, and we set off for, at the time, we thought was 7 years. And since then, we've written 2 books, and we're breaking even. So the trip's now as long as our bodies hold out.
And we can certainly talk about both books and mention the website, too, for people to reference to actually track what you've been doing and all the wonderful places you've ridden through over the past 7 years or so. That's I think it's downtheroad.org. Is that the correct website?
That's correct.
Okay.
Downtheroad.org.
Don't want to distract people, but there is a lot of information up there. And we'll provide book and contact information at the conclusion of the discussion as well this afternoon. Wanted to know, though, how much bicycle experience did you have prior to deciding to sell everything? Were you keeping up with Lance Armstrong? Were you a world cyclist or just recreational cyclist? What, a lot of cycling background.
At that point, we were recreational cycling. I was president of the bike club in Prescott, Arizona, and we were putting on a lot of small-town events and going on different bike rides with the club, but not racing or anything. We mountain biked and road biked before we left, so the biking part was an easy transition.
And I took up cycling a little bit before I met Tim, and then once I met Tim, I started riding more and more. And it's kind of funny, right before we left, we were so busy with taking care of all the details. We didn't have much time to ride. And so the 6 months before we left, we didn't even ride hardly at all. So our training preparation wasn't much. But what we ended up doing is just starting out slow.
And since I asked you about having had some experience cycling here in the States or in North America, and again, we'll talk about more of the specifics in the book and some very interesting individual experiences that you've had over the years, can you kind of compare and contrast what cycling is like here in the States compared to maybe the rest of the world, or maybe Australia wouldn't be a fair comparison, but China and South America and some of the other places you've been? How does that compare to your cycling experience in the States? Is it more difficult there, easier? Do people accept it more? Is it more affordable? What's the story?
Every place has its pluses and minuses for cycling. It's safe to say that New Zealand and Australia, the two industrialized countries we visited, it's a little easier there. People were a little more tolerant. We haven't been in North America too long, only 4 months, and that's only been Canada and the western part of the U.S., so it's kind of hard to draw a comparison thus far. But there's a lot more bike lanes and more riding to work and such. But that seems, that being said, that seems to be a very big growing bike movement in the States that we've noticed since we've come down the coast.
And I can add, in more third world countries, more people ride bikes, and you'll see people carry all kinds of things on bikes. I mean, even three people and chickens and everything on bikes. And it seems in some of the other third world, second world countries, people move a little bit slower. Drivers are more used to things being in the road, where in more developed countries, the cars are used to going faster. It's been a bit of an adjustment for me getting back into large metro areas.
And how many, I know you're probably tired of this question. I know you've been interviewed by Australian radio, and I've seen the web logs about your travels and that, but I'll have to ask the same question. How many miles or kilometers do you think you've driven or ridden on your bicycle since your departure in 2002? Do you have a rough idea?
I kind of keep track of that. We're around 35,000 miles, getting close to 40,000 miles, which is amazing when you think about it. It's a lot of miles.
And you mentioned earlier at the introduction that the original plan was roughly to be on the road worldwide for about 7 years. The book even suggests now that you're going to adopt the nomadic life indefinitely. Is that the case at this point?
That's the case. We're watching the economy. Because we do have an internet business and we sell books, and you know, if the economy takes a downturn, it'll hurt us like everybody else, and we'll have to adjust. But at the moment, and our plan is to go until we get tired of going.
Okay, so apparently during the war outbreak, you were somewhere in South America, if I have the timing correct. If you were or you weren't, can you tell us a bit what it's like being on a bicycle outside of North America during wartime, and what it's like being an American down in South America during that time?
The war actually started while we were in Costa Rica, and about a year later, the story you're talking about from the book happened in Argentina when all the dust settled and it was obvious how long this was going to last and what was involved.
And traveling abroad as an American, especially at the beginning of the Iraq War, people were very angry, and they didn't understand why American went into Iraq, and they certainly voiced their frustrations to us and sometimes a lot of anger. It was difficult to travel as an American. We tried the best we could to explain, you know, not all Americans think the same and do the, you know, want to be in Iraq. But at the time, people had the image that everyone in America wanted to be in Iraq.
But the thing I've noticed that's changed is early in the war, people were mad at America, and because we were Americans, they were often angry with us. As the war went on and politics went on, and a few years later, people actually were mad at George Bush and the Bush administration for the war and kind of seeing that there was a divide in America and understanding that we weren't all on the same page with this.
Okay, and I want to set the stage a little bit more clearly for listeners. In the book, you mentioned that you were relatively prepared to speak the language. Tell us a bit about your preparations in that regard, preparing for the cultures and the languages after you left the States.
In Mexico, we traveled for a couple months with not too much Spanish experience, and then we went to Spanish immersion school in Guanajuato, Mexico, which is a beautiful place. And I continued training in Xela, Quetzaltenango, Guatemala, which is another just stunning place. And as time went on, our Spanish improved, And so by the time we were in Chile, Argentina, we had an intermediate understanding of Spanish. And the more language you can speak, the more interaction you can get. It's a lot more fun. When we went to Southeast Asia, we had a phrase book for the many different languages there. And we had to learn a little Thai, a little Khmer, some Vietnamese. And then when we went into China for 9 months, we really had a long time to learn some Mandarin. And we learned a little bit of Mandarin in a English school. We kind of taught some English, learned some Mandarin, and then off we went. And it took me a good 6 months before I could not have to open that phrase book all the time.
And do you think that you were proficient enough in Spanish, especially in South America, to really have a true understanding of what people were talking about, their general feelings and these impressions that you left as far as the political, economic, and wartime environment? Did you have an understanding you felt?
Well, as a tourist, it's always difficult to get a true understanding of any place when you're just passing by. But certainly our knowledge of what we could speak in Spanish certainly helped compared to when we first entered Mexico and we didn't speak much Spanish. And there's a big difference between what we got out of the first year to the second year.
Okay. You talked a little bit earlier about being, I guess, basically an internet entrepreneur as far as books and websites and those kinds of things. Tell us a little bit more about the budget. Did you have a budget in mind when you left the States? Did you stick with that budget? And how is that budget holding up, especially now with all these economic concerns? In other words, how much money did you allocate yourselves each day? What does it take to survive on a bicycle for 7 years at 35,000 miles of travel?
Go ahead, Tim.
Well,
okay, maybe it's
basically in the beginning we lived on as little as we could. So in Latin America and much of Asia, we lived on mostly $20 a day, sometimes $25.
This is $20 total for the both of you,
right? Combined. As we went into Thailand and Malaysia, which get to be more expensive countries, but we started selling more and more books, and the website has exploded beyond belief for us, and it's gotten quite busy, and it's all been kind of shocking, and that helped us earn more money. And somewhere in Australia and New Zealand, we started breaking even with what we were spending and what we were earning. And so now these countries are more expensive, so we're earning and spending about $30 a day.
Okay. I don't need to pry too deeply into your personal finances, but it is a question, or I guess a concern. I mean, it's fascinating that you've been able to survive roughly on an average of maybe about $25 a day, and your plans are to travel indefinitely. But how long can this go on? I'm going to guess your age, maybe you're in your early 40s or so. Can you indeed do this indefinitely, and what will you do once you're older? And maybe can't ride as long or as hard, or maybe decide to settle down. What's the future hold for bicyclists?
Well, we have many friends that have gone through Africa and whatnot into their 60s. And recently, There's an Englishman who was quite old who's traveled around. So it definitely can be done late in life. But our retirement, we're nomadic at heart. So we can picture ourselves when we're too old to do the bike thing, to buy a motor home and park free in different places and live in it really cheaply and kind of travel around that way.
Okay. Voluntary simplicity. In addition to all the questions I've asked you and I'm about to ask, what typically do folks ask you when they encounter you in South America, China, and these other places? And I don't mean so much folks in the urban centers and the large cities, but maybe the rural folks, the farmers, they see two Americans cycling down the road. What typically is their reaction? What do they want to know about? Are they even fascinated with what you're doing?
We've had real varied responses. It's interesting. I remember in Central America, people asking us about America and having the impression that all of America is like our movies because they all see our movies. And I remember somebody asking us if we've ever seen a gunfight, you know, that kind of thing. And it was like, oh, no.
Arizona,
yeah. Yeah, well, we have spent so much time trying to tell people that, you know, America isn't like the movies. That's a movie. It's entertainment. It's not a documentary on Americans. And so all over the world, people think that we live like in the movies. And so that's been something that we've that's been challenging.
Okay. If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Metro. I'm Roger Wendell, and my guests this afternoon are Tim and Cindy Travis, authors of Down the Road in South America, a bicycle tour through poverty, paradise, and the places in between. Tim and Cindy left all their possessions and their home in Arizona in 2002 and have ridden nearly 40,000 miles around the world, averaging about $20-$25 a day in expenses, and plan on doing that indefinitely. And if you want to join the conversation, you can call us here at KGNU at 303-442-4242. That's 303-442-4242. And we'll give out book information and the web address again later at the end of the conversation. So getting back to what we were talking about, kind of the nomadic lifestyle, has your thirst or desire for travel been diminished at all? Have you satisfied even part of it, having driven 35,000 miles on your bicycle so far? Where are you at on the thermometer as far as desire for travel?
I'm still pretty high on the desire for travel. I'd say I've almost got the same curiosity as I did before. I guess now I have a little bit more experience. And I still want to see Africa. We haven't been to Africa and the Middle East and East Europe, and those are places we want to go, and I really want to see those places. I'd say that about the only thing that has kind of gotten old is packing. I mean, I don't mind unpacking, but it's the packing every morning that can kind of get monotonous. But we have it down to such a science. It's almost a dance in the morning that we know what we need to pack up. But I still love the thrill of going around the corner and seeing what's next and being in touch with what's out there. You know, we live outside, which is really quite a different existence than living in a house anymore. And so I really enjoy it.
Okay. We'll go to the phones in just a minute. Amy and others are waiting patiently, but I've got a couple more questions. And you mentioned packing. Tell us a little bit more about packing as far as how much weight are you carrying? What kind of bikes are these? I mean, on the website and in the book, there are some photographs of the bikes, and they look really loaded down to me. Tell us more about what you're carrying, the kinds of bikes, the gear in general.
Well, the pictures in the book from South America would be some of the heaviest our bikes have been because we were going long distances between anything, the water, electricity, food. So we were packed down for camping in the, you know, under the stars for days on end. Our gear, we don't travel light because this is where we live. We often say that it's a lot to travel with, but it's not much to live with. And it is practically everything we own. It's certainly everything that's with us. And my bike and gear with some food probably weighs about 100 pounds. And Cindy's bike probably weighs about 50 or 60 pounds.
And What about the types of bikes? I guess I didn't state that very clearly. As I know, maybe you're not at liberty to be advertising different brands of bicycles and that kind of thing, but just a general idea, these obviously wouldn't be a little commuter bike that we use in Denver to get down to the RTD stop or anything like that. This would be something special, a little bit more hardy.
Well, we meet people traveling on all kinds of bikes, but our bikes are specially built for heavy loads and bicycle touring. When our bags are off our bikes, we often think they feel really heavy. I often compare it to a one-ton pickup truck with nothing in the bed.
These are standard bicycles that you could get at a bicycle shop, or are they specially made or prepared for you?
They're special European bikes that are now available in Holland, and I don't know what the U.S. status is at the moment, but they're specially made for traveling. They're called Koga Miata. It's a Dutch bike.
Koga Miata. And this is the same bicycle since you've left Arizona, or have you changed bikes a few times since then?
We originally left on other bikes, and then partway through switched to these as a sponsor deal. And then when that was over, we kept the bikes.
Okay.
We've had these bikes for 5 years and the other ones for about 2 years.
So the same frame for 5 years. I know, yeah. In the book you talk a lot about flats and repairs, and I don't want to bring up the dark side of your travels, but I want to ask a little bit more about that. But Amy's been waiting patiently from Boulder. Let's see if she has a question. Amy, good afternoon. You're on Metro.
Good afternoon. I'm so excited. What a very adventuresome thing to do, but do you spend more than one night in one place? And maybe you already answered it, and I just came on late in the game. But I'm just wondering, is it bike, 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 or do you actually take time to stay in an area and get to know people, or are you always on the go?
That's a great question. Actually, it's addressed a few times in the book at length. Tim?
Because
I'm gonna
we
hang
have
up.
No
okay.
real
Thank you.
Destination or end in sight, we actually slow down a lot more than most people on the bike. So we definitely stay a week here and a couple of days there, and if we're really tired, a month or two somewhere else. So it's not bike every day by any means for us.
Okay. And I had asked earlier, kind of got into that direction, about bicycle maintenance. Have you become bicycle mechanics at this point? And do you maintain your own bikes? Obviously, you're changing your own flats. And you mentioned that a number of times throughout the book. Kind of flats are the nuisance that most cyclists have to live with. Tell us about that.
Before the trip, when I was in college, I worked in bike shops on and off all along. So I pretty much do all the bike work, and even for Cindy. So we do our own work, but I preempt things. I usually buy things before they break. So I'll buy tires before they completely wore out, or I'll buy a drivetrain before it's completely gone. And that just solves a lot of problems on the road.
And some of the extra gear that we carry is, especially in South America, because we're going through remote areas, we carried a folding tire. And this folding tire is made out of Kevlar, so it folds up and we can pack it in and carry it in Tim's tool bag. And we carry that in case a tire rips or is no longer any good. And in Bolivia, on the Salar de Uyuni, the largest salt flat in the world, we're riding across it. Tim gets a flat, pumps up the tire, and bam, the sidewall of the tire blows out. And if we didn't have that folding tire to put on Tim's bike, we would have had to walk like 40 kilometers to an island to get a ride, off the saw flat. But so we have to carry gear like that.
We carry a bit of extra tools and things because we're on the long haul and big things come up. So I pretty much have to have the tools to completely take the bike apart and put it back together.
Okay. 3:32 is the time. If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Metro. I'm Roger Wendell. My guests are Tim and Cindy Travis, authors of Down the Road in South America, a bicycle tour through poverty, paradise, and the places in between. They left the United States about 7 years ago, have traveled nearly 40,000 miles on their bicycles, and have averaged about $25 a day in expenses. If you have any questions or want to join the conversation, you can call us at 303-442-4242. Let's go back to the phones. Kathy's been waiting patiently. Good afternoon, Kathy. You're on Metro.
Hi. This is just so inspiring. And one of the things that strikes me as so fabulous is that you're not only writing, but you're writing. And so I was hoping you could talk a little bit about your writing process. Like, when do you sit down to write, and where, et cetera, et cetera.
That's a pretty good question. We have our office with you. We carry with us. We carry our computer. Pretty much, that's what we pull out. A lot of times, we're in our tent and writing. Sometimes at a picnic table. Sometimes in a kitchen. We have set up and wrote wherever we could and tried to make ourselves comfortable. It's amazing the places that we have sat down and typed.
Yeah, but I mean, I miss the days of having an office where you come back to the same place and you can work on the computer and write at the same place. But we just don't have that. We live nomadically, so it's a park bench and, like Cindy said, the tent often. The rainy nights in the tent are big, pull out the computer and, you know, do some things on the computer at times. It's often on battery. We're usually working until the battery goes dead, and then we charge it the next day at a laundromat or a grocery store or something like that.
Kathy, any other questions?
No, that was great. Thank you very much.
Okay, thanks for your call. And you can join the conversation on your community radio station by calling 303-442-4242. And again, my guests are Tim and Cindy Travis, authors of Down the Road in South America. Throughout the book, you do mention, not throughout the book, at times in the book, you mention the writing process and the computer. Tell us a little bit more, though, about maintaining batteries. Has that been an issue in South America and other parts of the world, keeping the batteries charged? Do you use a solar panel, or what's the story?
I originally thought I would leave with a solar panel because that was a big question. Where am I going to get power? But I eventually traded that in on an extension cord, not literally, but I eventually sent it home and bought an extension cord. And what I learned was there's enough laundry mats and things like that out there. If we're on really long stretches between electricity, we tend to not to pull the computer out as much. I have a double capacity battery, too, which gives me at least 8 hours of computer time. So we might break that into three different nights or something that we would work on it on battery. And often there's always a restaurant or a laundromat's a big one we're doing nowadays, or a public library where we can plug in, or different people's houses we're staying in, or there just always seems to be a plug around, and that's been not such a hard thing. I just use bigger batteries and charge them when we need to.
And I have to say, Tim, we use rechargeable batteries for our lights, our MP3 player and all that, and Tim is really good about keeping things charged. Whenever we have a plug, it's amazing what we have pulled out in the library and set up to plug in. And most people are fine. Okay, no problem. And that's how we do it.
I think that I and probably many of the listeners would take crossing borders for granted. Many of us are accustomed to flying into another city in another country and going through customs. But you're carrying all this equipment, these lights and batteries and computers, on a bicycle and going through customs and checkpoints on old dirt roads, and sometimes through disputed border areas in South America and different countries. Your experience crossing borders with all this equipment must be much different than me taking a bottle of suntan lotion down to Mexico on a flight. What's it like crossing these borders with all this equipment and computers? Is there any concern or worry about hanging on to these possessions?
Well, definitely borders are like a bottleneck where people are passing through. So at these busy places, you also have pickpockets, and there's border officials, and you may or may not have to pay different fines. Every border crossing is a little different, but it's definitely a place where we take all of our valuables and put them deeper inside our bags. We're very aware of what's around us, and we just try to get through it with whatever situation arises.
And you mentioned in the book that you believe airport officials to be less corrupt than those at the borders. Maybe you could compare and contrast those kinds of border crossings for us.
Well, in the airport, everything's much more on the up and up, and we had to pay a lot to fly with our bikes from Bogota, Colombia, to Quito, Ecuador. And usually, often when you travel a lot, you learn how to say, well, is there yes, sir, is there any way I can pay for you to take care of this for me? And you kind of negotiate a price and you pay it. But that doesn't really go, or my experience is that doesn't work at the airport. When we were crossing from Nicaragua to Honduras, they asked us for essentially a title and registration for the bikes. And, of course, that doesn't exist. We don't have anything like that. So, you know, you just had to be on guard. And we just said, well, you know, can we give you some money to take care of the paperwork for us and to take care of this problem? And it wound up being $10, and you slide through. So it's the two things at the border. The crowd that's there knows people are coming through with all their possessions and money, and the officials know that you've got money on you too. So it's always a little tough. Sometimes it's a breeze. Sometimes it's hard. You never know what's going to happen when you cross borders.
Exactly. 3:39 is the time. You're listening to Metro. If you want to join the conversation, give us a ring at 303-442-4242. Tim and Cindy, I want to do a little quote here directly from your book. I don't want to bore everybody with quoting too much, but some of this was pretty interesting. And you say, this extended nomadic lifestyle has been both good and bad on our health. Obviously, all the exercise and fresh air has been great for our fitness, but of course, fitness is only one component of health. The wear and tear that months on end of exposure to the elements and foreign cultures breaks down our bodies and speeds up the aging process. To last this long on the road takes a different kind of endurance. International bike touring is less about cycling several hours a day and more about being durable, adaptable, open-minded, and just plain old tough. Your comment.
Well, that's true. I'd have to say, after being on the road for this long, some of our health problems have been the most challenging of anything. I would much rather ride up the Andes for 3 days and down for 1 day than have to deal with health problems. And most of the time, it revolves around bacteria problems, stomach ailments. Tim contracted a parasite that has totally drained him of any energy, and it took a long time to figure out what was wrong with him. And the other thing, on the road, you don't have your own personal doctor, so you're going somewhere else, and so they don't have that interest, you know, you're not their patient, and it's just a little bit different care than you would get from your own home doctor. And I recently got shingles when we were up in Canada, and trying to ride with that, it's hard. Sometimes having a home base helps with these kind of things.
Well, you know what? Go ahead.
Some of the wear and tear just comes from being outside all the time and in the wind and in the cold and in the rain. And, you know, you get kind of weathered. We're living indoors. You don't. So, you know, it's a lot of sun. It's a lot of wind. It can be cold. So there's a lot of just exposure to the outside that's tiring. And then just so much stimulus. We're always learning something new. And if we're in a foreign country and there's new foods and languages and money, and you really get bombarded with information. And it's tiring in a different kind of way, kind of a mental tiring.
Yeah, I have to say I had a small taste of that. I went to China, and I was not prepared for the languages. And this was prior to the Olympics. And, you know, a couple thousand miles west of Beijing, it was just exhausting trying to order a meal or figure out where the next hotel or road was going to be just because of the language barrier, and nobody's fault but my own. You know, last night during the debate, they certainly talked about health care and those kinds of issues. I wonder what your perspective is on health care at this point, maybe health insurance, and how do you deal with that? What if you do come down with a serious ailment or injury that requires more than an antibiotic or something that you can purchase locally? What are you going to do on the road, or what have you done on the road for the past 7 years as far as health insurance or those kinds of issues?
Well, that was a tricky one. It was really tricky. And when we first left, we didn't have insurance, and it just bothered me. And finally, when we went into South America after our first year of travel, I found an insurance company that would cover us for health insurance as long as we were outside the U.S. And that's the key, because the difference in health care costs outside the U.S. and inside the U.S. is pretty big. And so we've been covered by that for the last 5 years, And then just recently, you know, they don't have, you know, they don't cover people in the U.S. It's just a difference in price. And so just recently we had to figure out what we were going to do for health insurance when we got back into the States. And it took a lot of research on the Internet and looking at plans. And we just recently, 2 months ago, purchased new health insurance to cover us inside the United States. And it is a large percentage of our monthly expense to cover health insurance. But we feel like we don't want, you know, we need, it's an essential item. We can't live without it.
Cindy, maybe we could put your health in the spotlight for a moment, only because you mentioned it in the book. I wonder if you'd care to share here with 20,000 close friends listening to this program your experience with an infection on the road, on the bicycle, what that cost, what you had to go through, and maybe the quality of care and the quality of some of the studies they did to determine what your problem was.
Oh, yeah.
I'm speaking cryptically, but...
Yeah, okay. In Peru, we were riding, and I had what I thought may be a bladder infection, but I needed to go get a test to make sure that's what it was. And I went to the main health, the public hospital in Puno, Peru, which is up on Lake Titicaca, and our Spanish was good enough at that point to go through the whole administrative procedure and answer all the questions. And then just walking into the hospital was amazing. There were people everywhere. You know, the halls were not empty. There were people standing everywhere. And a woman led us around from one place to another to take me to the doctor. And find, you know, I had to explain to him in Spanish that I was having painful urination, and he said, okay, we need to get you tested. So he sent me down to the laboratory to get a test, and he said, go, you know, pick up your sterile cup at the laboratory and submit it. So I go to the laboratory, and I asked for, you know, the specimen cup, and they didn't have any. And so I was at a loss. What was I going to do? And as I was trying to think of what to do next, the woman who had taken us from one place to another comes running down the hall, and she has a Coke bottle in her hand, and she's shaking the water out of it. And she comes up to me and says, here, put your sample in this. And I was amazed. I was like, oh, no. So I took the Coke bottle. I mean, I really wanted to get medication to cure up this infection. And I go into the bathroom, and I could barely touch the sides of the wall. I mean, everything was just not clean. And then getting my specimen in the Coke bottle was another challenge. I finally get that process done, and I come down the hall, and I'm holding my Coke bottle full of urine, and a woman runs into the back of my arm, and I almost lose everything on the floor, and it was just... I could not believe that I had a urine sample in a Coke bottle, and I gave it to the laboratory, and they said, come back in an hour. And I came back, and somehow they managed to get a good sample out of that. And I was positive, and I ended up getting an antibiotic, and it cost something like $3 US to buy the antibiotic.
$3 US for the whole.
Uh-huh. And it really was amazing to me that here we were in a public hospital and they didn't have anything, any kind of sterile cups to take samples. And I was just a shock. I wondered how people could get proper care.
What kind of perspective does that give you on the U.S. healthcare system? And we don't need to dwell on it a whole lot, but how do you look at the controversy going on here? Do you think, related to your experience, that we've got it pretty well here, even though it's incredibly expensive, but as far as the procedures and the technology and the availability, I don't want to put words into your mouth, but compare and contrast, if you would.
By far... we have a lot of health care. We have a lot available to us. The testing is good. Things that we take for granted, that your blood sample is going to be good. The needles we use are clean, and the specimen cups are clean. I mean, a lot of things that we go, well, that's, you know, that we take for granted. other people don't have. And, you know, I wonder about passing infections from one person to another in those kinds of hospitals. It certainly wasn't clean and sanitary like we see here, and the procedures we're used to. Imagine surgery. I mean, how does that go? It's scary. And so we do have a much higher level of health care here, but the scary side is a lot of people don't have health insurance here, and that's not good.
To me, it depends on what country you're talking about. I mean, in New Zealand and Australia, there's certainly first-rate health care. We went to a hospital in Bangkok that catered to foreigners, but it was a five-star hospital and top of the line. The hospital she went to in Peru was a public hospital, and it was on the lower end of the scale. But it really depends on the country. I mean, most countries in the developed world have a real similar level of care, and what I call an international level of care.
Okay. 3:49 is the time. You're listening to KGNU. I'm Roger Wendell. This is Metro, and my guests are Tim and Cindy Travis, authors of Down the Road in South America, A Bicycle Tour Through Poverty, Paradise, and the Places in Between. And we've been talking about all kinds of things. You mentioned Peru, and it's certainly featured prominently in the book. I think it's probably one of the larger chapters. Tell us everything about Peru. And I don't want to dissuade people. A lot of good things happen. There's a lot of uplifting parts to the book. I know we've dwelled on a little bit of negativity here, which is the reality in the third world. But Peru is very interesting to me on a number of levels, reading that chapter in your book. But tell us about it.
Peru was an exciting place. It was a sobering place. With the scenery in Peru has to be some of the most stunning we've seen. Just gorgeous mountains, crystal clear. But the level of poverty in Peru is just heart-wrenching. Places that didn't have running water, cities of 10,000 people didn't have running water. Food was up in the Altiplano. You're at a high altitude, over 12,000 feet. Vegetables don't grow very well up there, so it's a lot of potatoes and chicken and not many vegetables, and the people live a hard life. And one of the things I remember meeting some Peruvians, and when I found out we were the same age, it was amazing because they looked 20 years older than I am. You know, they looked older, and their life expectancy is less.
We can't even imagine the poverty, and I think you had a pretty good look at it. In the book, you mentioned you were there 89 or 90 days, so you saw virtually every nook and cranny, or at least a lot of things that the average American tourist in Peru wouldn't see. You saw a lot of the small villages and the back roads and dirt roads.
We did.
We like to say on a bike, you see it all, for better or worse. I mean, whether you want to or not, you're going to see what you're going to see along that road.
And I do want to add, we have met some of the most wonderful people in Peru as well. And in particular, we met a man named Lucho who has a Casa de Ciclista, which is a house for cyclists. And he opens his house up to cyclists that are touring through South America. And he's in Trujillo, Peru. And you can stay there. And he does it by donation. And he has a bike shop there. And so you have a place to work on your bikes, and it's very international. We met Fritz, a German man we rode with for 2 months after we met him at Lucho's. It has everything. South America just has everything.
Okay, and I didn't want to dwell on the negative, but some of this was really interesting throughout the book. You mentioned in a couple of places in Peru, people shouting at you, gringo. Tell us a little bit about that, and also about some of maybe the encounters for people demanding money, maybe a rope across the road, those kinds of things. A lot of pressure from the poverty.
Yeah, people are quite poor, and they don't see too many foreign people, or i.e. white people, riding through. So we stick out pretty hard. And so I'm not for sure why they would constantly yell gringo at us like we would forget, but I don't know where that came from, but it was certainly a common theme through a lot of the really impoverished areas of the highlands and the Andes. Just the kids would run at us and just chant, gringo, 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 and we didn't quite know what to make of it. It didn't seem to always make sense to us.
And in parts of Peru, people would constantly ask us for money, Can I have your bike? Can I have your helmet? And it certainly, they had the impression from foreigners that foreigners had so much that they could just hand them a bike and walk away and go get another one. And I think the pressure of tourism when you have such, you know, especially around Machu Picchu, which is a stunning place, but a lot of tourists go there, and I think they hand out things, and they don't realize when they leave that the impression they leave, or if they come to hand out pencils, they don't have pencils for everyone. We would ride through a town, and the kids are beating each other up to get to us first, and suddenly, you know, we met a teacher there, and he said, because they know there's only so many pencils. And, you know, it's like, oh, maybe we shouldn't be handing out pencils. Maybe we should be giving it to the school. And so I think if the way Peruvians have been helped by people outside their country hasn't always been a good, in a sense that it leaves some people left out.
So what do you think is responsible tourism? And I've traveled a little bit, and I know that sometimes we've made donations to local schools and stuff, but it's like you described. Sometimes there's a mob scene, and the more aggressive kids end up receiving gifts, pencils, and those kinds of things. But in your opinion, from 40,000 miles of experience on a bicycle, what is responsible tourism? What should you do, or should you do anything?
Well, we definitely giving things out to individuals can teach that individual that there's handouts coming. If when we helped people, we usually would help either the church or the school, because I was a teacher, I have an interest in schools. And if you want to give a bunch of pencils to the kids, give it to the school, who will ration them and use them for school.
But do you even recommend that? Do you recommend that, though, for somebody traveling, you know, traditionally or even on a bicycle, to bring gifts along to donate to a school? Is that your recommendation?
If you found a school that you felt like you wanted to donate to, I would buy what you needed locally in Peru, and they sell pencils in the different stores there. And you could do that as you feel comfortable as you go. But I would buy it there.
Yeah, and handing something to somebody, handing out money, and it sounds good, but in a way, it takes away people's dignity, and It puts you on a different level. And I over and over again, not just South America, but Southeast Asia as well, people who worked with the schools and the churches seemed to do a better job. And then people didn't look at every foreigner that came by as money bags, as someone who would just hand them money, because that's what we were looked at in places where people had just come in, given out things, and left. They thought, oh, they're here to give me something. And sometimes when we didn't give them something, we had rocks thrown at us. And so it that's quite aggressive. And it was intense to deal with that. And that starts somewhere.
And for somebody that's just tuned in and heard that you've been cycling around the world, and some locals, not many, but a small minority, may have thrown rocks at you. That's not a unique experience to Tim and Cindy Travis. According to your book, other cyclists and other tourists had similar problems in Peru and parts of Bolivia.
Yeah, we met people who've had that problem. And for experienced travelers who have gone through impoverished parts of Africa, and we've had friends that have the same problem there, that, you know, when you hand things out, you teach people to ask for things. And you teach people to be beggars in a lot of ways. And so I would prefer to give it to an organization and let them do it. And I'm a big believer in the schools. I think they do a lot of good down there.
Okay. I've got about 24 more questions, but unfortunately only 2.5 more minutes. But I wanted to touch on this. Cindy commented in the book about the lack of equal rights for women in some parts of the world. Cindy, what's been your experience cycling through some of these countries as a woman? Have you been treated differently than Tim? What's it been all about?
Yeah, I'd have to say I have. It certainly is better to be a foreign woman than sometimes a local woman. I saw that I had more rights because I was with Tim or something like that, you know, with him, I assumed. In the Latin American countries, Mexico, I recall, I would ask a question in Spanish, and they would answer to Tim. And I was like, it's a cultural thing, and having to deal with that. And women, where in Asia, women were a little bit more equal. But Latin America was quite interesting. I tell you, I'm glad to be an American and realize that we have a lot better equal footing, and some things have a long way to go in other countries.
Okay, we're running out of time. I'm wondering if you, either of you, Tim, Cindy, if you have recommendations for somebody that may have tuned in and said, you know, I'd sure like to get rid of all my belongings and travel the world on my bicycle, or maybe jog across the United States, or just do something out of the ordinary. What's your recommendation or advice for that kind of listener at this point that wants to take off and do something as bold as what you've done for the past 7 years?
Well, if you put your mind to it, you can make almost anything happen. You have to make the right choices in life, and you have to put your mind to it, and you have to work for it. As far as wanting to travel like us on the bike, we meet a lot of people who I think say they would love to do what we do. But I think after a year with us, they get tired of sitting on the ground and sleeping in a tent and things like that. So I think it may seem more glamorous than it is.
And I would recommend start locally. If you want to do a bike ride, start out your back door. And a number of times we met people landing in a foreign country and cycling for the first time. There's a lot of things to work out when you first get started. And it's better to be close to home and places where you can get tires or adjust things. And so I recommend you start locally. If you want to do a bike tour, do one in your backyard first. That's how Tim started me, was just, you know, a couple local trips. And then that way there you can see if you like it.
Okay. This wasn't a spur-of-the-moment trip. We were calculating, and we'd really thought about it, and we had weighed our pluses and minuses of it. This wasn't a knee-jerk reaction. This was all very methodically thought out.
Okay. Unfortunately, we're out of time. It's been a very fast hour. How can folks learn more about what you're doing, track your progress around the world, and maybe obtain a copy of the book?
The best place to start with us and looking for books, or we have 20,000 pictures on the website, and we have videos, and Cindy keeps a daily journal. There's a couple thousand entries for that. Would be just simply at the front of our website, www.downtheroad.org.
Okay.